WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. A longtime Donald Trump friend today suggesting that the former president's attorney Michael Cohen doesn't always tell the truth and that a grand jury investigating Trump should not rely on Cohen's testimony. Today's new witness is former Cohen attorney Bob Costello.
What I'm going to do, ultimately, is release the materials that I gave to the Manhattan DA's office and to Trump's lawyers to the media and let you guys read everything.
The case centers on an alleged campaign finance violation and hush money paid to a porn actress. Los Angeles schools expecting a strike tomorrow. Food service workers, custodians, special education assistants, all supported by teachers over a pay dispute. Thousands of workers involved. Police arresting a student they say fired a gun in a Dallas area high school today, killing one student and injuring another. They arrested the shooter, Arlington Police Chief Al Jones.
As a dad, I was disturbed because it's, you know, it's a kid.
This is ABC News. The up and down price at the pump continues.
After increases that were blamed on refineries around the U.S., switching to more expensive summer blends of gasoline, now a bit of a dip. The price of regular unleaded went down 3 cents in the past week to $3.42 a gallon, according to new data from the Energy Department. Regular unleaded is today 82 cents a gallon less than it was a year ago when Russia's invasion of Ukraine was unfolding. The cheapest gas is along the Gulf Coast at $3.02 a gallon. Alex Stone, ABC News.
The president inviting a lot of guests to the White House this week. He and the First Lady hosting an Iranian New Year celebration there today. Tomorrow, President Biden awards the 2021 National Medals of Arts and National Humanities Medals to legends including Bruce Springsteen, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Gladys Knight, Jose Feliciano, and Vera Wang. Prominent writers including Amy Tan, Colson Whitehead, and Walter Isaacson also getting honors in an East Room ceremony. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Barron, Saturdays and Sundays at noon on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
All right, who's ready to eat? We got brats for dinner, marshmallows for dessert.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is asking property owners to keep an eye out for spongy moth eggs this spring. Look for tan lumps about the size of a nickel or a quarter on trees or on buildings. Formerly known as gypsy moths, spongy moths are an invasive species which kill trees by eating all the leaves. The DNR expects an outbreak is likely to continue and that the moths will keep spreading. The National Club Curling Championships wrapped up this weekend in Wausau. 24 teams from across the country took part in the games. New York winning first place in the women's competition. Colorado took home the prize for the men. And the Wisconsin women's hockey team are the national champions after defeating Ohio State in Sunday's title game. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
Kids. They're just different than us. They have no inhibitions, consider silverware optional, and can find fun anywhere. And when kids get really sick, they're different than us too. Until now, children diagnosed with blood cancer have been treated like many adults. Not anymore. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society proudly introduces the Dare to Dream Project, transforming treatment and care through advocacy, education, and the largest global clinical trial for kids with blood cancer. For the first time, a specific treatment can be matched to a specific type of cancer in a specific child. It'll be the biggest medical advancement for little patients in history. Dare to dream with us. Support the Dare to Dream Project and all the work that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society does at lls.org.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
And download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Want to spend a little time talking about my weekend. Had a great weekend. Spent a little time up in New England. A friend and my son and my daughter, we went away. Went to see a concert in Boston. Made our way up the coast. Up 1A into Maine. Saw light towers. But what we saw was, well, traditional New England. And as someone who likes labor history, as someone who wants to learn as much as I can about labor history, being in that area where, you know, the 1800s, you know, textile mills were huge in that part of the country into the early 1900s. And we made our way into Lawrence, where the, you know, the Bread and Roses strike, that whole area, the whole Lawrence, Haverhill, Methuen, you know, that whole area right there where you had all of these textile mills. And what's interesting, you know, we went to a number of these places, Saco, Maine, and Lawrence and Lowell, and you know, just as we had gone to, you know, former textile strongholds of the past, you know, think of Reading, Pennsylvania being another one. What they're now doing with these spaces, you know, these enormous facilities, the enormous buildings, that, you know, when I was last in Lawrence was like 30 years ago. You know, they were basically all just crumbling. I mean, the windows were being all broken out. It was just abandoned kind of buildings that, you know, from the outside, you saw nothing but desperation. And now there's some investment going in to build these up, make high density living, you know some kind of light manufacturing, light commercial, you know, art kind of things, like a lot of communities have done. And there's some activity, and that's a good thing. But, you know, my mind went to this place of remembering the Bread and Roses strike and remembering the history that went through there. And one of the things that my mind kept going back to is one of the things that led to the desperation and the exploitation in places like Lawrence and Lowell, and, you know, name the textile mills, you know, the advent of mechanization, of machinery, of assembly line work, where you took, you know, skilled craftspeople and you basically made their skill worthless, because now you can bring in a whole bunch of cheap immigrants to do assembly line, piecemeal kind of work for poverty wages. And look, you know, the capitalists of the era, they didn't waste any time in going to a more exploitive model. But as I was looking through this, and I was thinking about the history of all this, we're kind of in a weird moment like this as well, because we're going through a major technological change period. I mean, with AI and all of the automation that's coming, you know, this push. And one of the things that I had forgotten about the Bread and Roses strike is that January 1st of 1912, the state of Massachusetts actually passed a law, capping the number of hours that these women could work in these textile mills from 56 down to 54. And the people were upset because, you know, the companies were going to cheat them out of those 2 hours. They needed all of those hours to survive. And even then, understand, not a great existence. So we're talking bread and water, basically, which is why out of this strike, why it was called the Bread and Roses Strike. Bread, yes. Our labor should bring us at least this, but something better. Bread, yes, but roses, too. Being the call of this strike. And it got me thinking about, you know, where we're heading and why history is so important. And look, these were horrible, horrible conditioned places where you had, you know, in owners, the CEOs of the day, thrilled at the ability to have exploitable labor, cheap, exploitable, domestic, local labor, good, cheap, young, exploitable domestic labor, good, cheap, young, exploitable women and girl labor. And they put them into their sweatshops. And you look at some of the numbers that come out of this. And I looked it up today when I was sitting thinking about this, where, you know, half of the workers in the mills there were females between 14 and 18 years old. And you go, target much? Yes. And in fact, some of them, a large percentage, under the age of 14. Now, the rules were you couldn't have them under 14. They kind of put that into place, but nobody ever really cared about that number. And this is what stuck with me. This, you know, they were falsifying birth certificates so that they could get, you know, 11, 12, 8, 9, 10-year-olds into the mills because the families were desperate. They needed to be able to keep a roof over their head, food on the table. They needed more people in the workforce. So you created this environment where cheating was a must. I mean, you had to do it. And I look at where we're going today. In fact, I was just reading a story over at the Washington Examiner, a right-wing rag in my view, but they're honest. You got to give them credit. The headline: Arkansas just made child labor easier, and that's a good thing. And you know, my mind goes was kind of in this bread and roses era of, you know, sending kids off to the mill to have to work in dangerous conditions. Because understand, these were grueling, dangerous, brutal jobs. Life expectancy, and this blew me away. The average life expectancy for the people of Lowell was 39 years old. Half of the children died. Half died before they were 6 years old. 36% of adults who died, who worked in the mill, died before they were 25 years old. And you stop and you think about this and you go, but Rick, we're so much better than that. And you go, are we? When you look at the fact that, in fact, I was just reading this story before I went on air, that we have a pregnancy death rate 10 times higher than Australia, than Spain, than Japan. Again, remember, we're the richest country in the world at the wealthiest moment in history. Hands down. And yet, what are we doing legally? Arkansas just made it easier to put people to work. Now, the article goes into, well, you know, when we were kids, everyone had paper routes and everyone did these jobs. And look, I'm all in favor of teenagers having those kind of learn life skills, show up on time, do a good job, be committed, follow through. All of those lessons you learn as a young worker. Absolutely on board with it. But where you're moving into an environment where, like in 1912, that 8, 9, 10-year-old's income was what the family needed. The family was desperate and needed this. Now understand, we're moving into a technological change era. There's going to be a lot of friction. There's going to be a lot of turmoil. And I see states kind of just making it a little bit easier. For instance, have you seen any of the economic reporting coming out that's saying that Americans are carrying much more credit card debt, more car loan debt, and the other side of that, having less savings. Now, again, a lot of this has to do with inflation and just how crazy the inflation rate has been and how it's harming working families. And people are just struggling to keep up. It seems to me that as we're doing this kind of stuff, you know, just loosening the rules a little bit. So, you know, yeah, in Iowa, they're advocating for, you know, kids working on the kill floor of the poultry factories. What it seems to me, and this is where the struggle I have with this is, as we move towards the next great recession / depression, because all the numbers seem to be going in the wrong way. We've got a Federal Reserve making all the wrong decisions. I think you've got a Republican-led Congress hell-bent on hamstringing our ability to deal with anything in the future. And you've got a greedy corporate special interest going up more for us and screw everybody else. It seems like we're heading back towards some pretty negative times. And now I'm looking at the easing of child labor requirements, and I'm looking again back at this history and remembering where we came from. Now, again, you know, what's that saying? You know, those who don't learn history are doomed to repeat it. I fear we're dooming ourselves to repeating some of the horrible things of the past. And that comes to the fact that we haven't had major labor law reform in this country to help workers fight for better wages, hours, and conditions so that they can weather these inflationary storms. So that when technological changes happen, they have a voice at the table, because it's going to happen. Much like it happened to these textile workers throughout New England. I mean, you think of the textile industry in this country. They went from skilled craftspeople, individuals selling their wares, to corporations, an owner, a corporate boss, figuring out how to bring them all in-house, and then figuring out how to take their skills and turn it into assembly work and bringing in the cheapest labor, the most exploitable labor you can get to pump out all of their units. And then on top of that, controlling all of their other needs, their housing. Because if you look at Lawrence, it's set up as a factory town where all of it's centered around this giant behemoth of a building where everybody was attached to that. Healthcare, education, groceries, all your personal needs, all controlled by the owner class. I fear we're moving somewhat back in those directions. And for me, this weekend was one of those moments of how do we deal with this? And I think that our elected leaders, especially in red states, are making all of the wrong decisions. Instead of strengthening labor requirements, we're loosening them. Instead of regulating things a lot better, we're deregulating. Because, hey, you know, corporate America, they're going to do what's in their best interest. Yes, make profit for themselves. We've got a lot of work ahead of us. Want to hear your thoughts. Have you ever been to Lawrence? Have you seen these giant factory places and the devastation after they've been closed? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, again, I come back to this, and the policies that we've moved on are, I think, are moving us in the wrong direction, be it the Fed's policies, these Republican states loosening child labor laws, and the fact that we forget what the past really was about. I think we're moving in the wrong direction. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are we doing?
We're doing okay. I just wanted to say that when they start doing these things, obviously, education is going to be lacking. And, of course, obviously, that means that these children are going to be stuck in these low-paying jobs. And then if there's a crash, if something happens, that these industries are no longer in that specific area, then they're going to be out of a job. So I'm going to assume that the next thing that we're going to come up with is workhouses. And my cousin got her hands on the records of the workhouse for the little county that we live in. And she is going to be transcribing the names, and then I am going to be doing the research, and we're going to actually write a book.
Good.
About these people and how they were used and abused. And I actually found out that I had a relative, I guess it would be like a 3 times great aunt, that had been put in this workhouse. And when she died, they took and sold her body for scientific purposes. I have the death certificate. This is in the 30s.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're going backwards. So apparently when they say they want to live in the old days, they're talking about 11th or 12th century. But have a good evening, Rick.
Thanks so much, Alice. Appreciate it. No, I mean, I'm waiting for workhouses to come back, debtors' prisons, because we're all going to, sadly, a lot of people are going in debt just to make ends meet. And I go back to that battle cry, bread, yes, but roses, too, the idea that life is more than just your work and that your work should be able to get you something more than just the bare minimums. It's just, well, again, this is where we're heading. And they're not shy about it. Speaking of not shy about it, over the weekend, the former president, Donald Trump, said that he was going to be indicted. Again, you got to give this guy credit. He is masterful at manipulating the media. He doesn't know when this is coming, but he's again trying to rile the base. And what was interesting to me is, you know, summoning the mob. I was up in New Hampshire, you know, live free or die. And there were no militia people out taking back the country. I didn't see the mob defending his honor. Just crickets. I saw a lot of social media posts, a lot of it. But I'm not seeing the mega militia, the MAGA militia out there taking back America. Most of them, I got to think, most people don't really care. But, you know, what it got me thinking about, the Reagan era. And over the weekend, a story came out over at the New York Times. We've all heard the phrase October surprise. We've all heard this. And it goes back to 1980. You know, Operation Eagle Claw, you know, Carter went to send, choppers and the military in to rescue the hostages in Iran, and it failed miserably. And there was a lot of conspiracy around why and how and all of that stuff, but it failed. And had that succeeded or been allowed to succeed, and I've heard conspiracy theories all up and down the row, I believe he'd have been reelected because he was painted as someone who was weak. He needed that to go well. And it was always believed that George H.W. Bush, former head of the CIA, and a number of Republican operatives were going throughout the Middle East making promises to Iran and to other diplomats saying, you know, don't release the hostages, tell that group that's holding our hostages, just those 53 people, just hold them a little bit longer Just keep holding them. Don't give Carter the win. Just hold them a little bit longer because Reagan's going to give you a better deal. You're going to get more out of Reagan than Carter was willing to offer. Because remember, the mantra has been America doesn't deal with terrorists. America does not negotiate. I'm sure you've heard this 1,000 times. And yet what we found out is the Reagan era was all about negotiating with terrorists. The Iran-Contra scandal was nothing but us giving, arms for drugs. I mean, it was, again, this is another one of those moments where in the years past, it was all conspiracy. It was all whispers. No, it's been proven. In fact, you had, 138 of Reagan's people, his cabinet members, his campaign people investigated, indicted, or convicted. His was the most corrupt administration. I would even argue more corrupt than Trump was, because it wasn't Trump's people. It wasn't Trump's people breaking all the rules. It was just Trump himself. And I still remember the testimony of all of these people, whether it was Ali North or Reagan himself. Reagan himself, when questioned about Iran-Contra, I think it was like 120, 124 times he did the, I don't recall. He didn't plead the fifth. He's like, I didn't recall. I don't recall. I don't remember. I don't recall. I don't recall. And that was, everyone going, wow, so he's got dementia. It was one of these things, we let it go. And then when he left office, we're like, well, yeah, he was corrupt. Yeah, there was all the drugs for arms things. Yeah, he was corrupt, but yeah, he's gone now. Let sleeping dogs lie. That was the phrase I heard most often. Well, over the weekend, you had a New York Times article that came out that said this former Texas Lieutenant Governor Ben Barnes has now come forward and said, yeah, back in that time period, I was being, marched around by former Texas Governor John Connolly. We did this trip throughout the Middle East. And guess what? We asked a bunch of Arab leaders to communicate to Iranian officials, telling them what? That they shouldn't release the hostages because Reagan would give them a better deal. Now, this is 43 odd years later. This is a long time past. Let sleeping dogs lie. It's 20 years since we invaded Iraq on a lie. A presidential administration lied bold-faced to us. George H.W. Bush going into Iraq because of Kuwait. That was a lie. I still remember the moment that I questioned whether we should be going in or not going in. And I still remember the candy striper on 60 Minutes. Telling the story about how Iraqi soldiers were taking babies out of incubators, throwing them on the floor. And yet, she wasn't in the country. Her testimony was fabricated by a PR firm to gin up outrage. And you think about these things, lie after lie after lie. I was thinking about today. Had those hostages been released, Carter probably gets reelected. You still have solar panels on the White House. We're moving further down the road on a green economy. The Patco workers don't get fired. We have stronger labor rights, a stronger middle class. Carter doesn't go full on tax cut from 70% all the way down to 28%. Our debt is less than $1 trillion. It quadruples over. We don't do that. We are a completely different country. Completely different country. Because of, these kind of shenanigans. And you go, but Reagan didn't do it. No, but George H.W. Bush, who was head of the CIA, had the contacts to do it. And this is why I think it's so important to hold Trump accountable. Because we haven't held people accountable for their lies and their crimes. And this is why people are so jaded about our political system. Because we've all, they broke the law. Yeah, they did bad. But they're gone now. Let sleeping dogs lie. How much longer are we going to put up with that? I want to hear your thoughts. Is it worth indicting Trump? Is this something that should happen? Do you think he'll go to jail? Because personally, I don't. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithshow.com. Got any questions, comments? By all means, angry responses to the top, as always. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1905. That was the day a boiler explosion destroyed the R.B. Grover shoe factory in Brockton, Massachusetts. The boiler exploded as workers arrived for the day shift. 58 workers were killed and another 150 were injured. The boiler reportedly shot up through all three floors and the roof of the building. The floors collapsed and the walls caved in. Those who survived the initial explosion were fatally trapped by debris and machinery. Fires spread rapidly throughout the plant, igniting by broken gas lines and industrial solvents. The entire block, including nearby homes and businesses, were leveled to the ground. Many of the dead were never positively identified. The Leather Workers Union provided financial assistance. So did R.B. Grover, who was ruined financially by the disaster. Boiler inspectors concluded the explosion was caused by a manufacturing defect that was virtually impossible to detect. The courts held no one liable. By 1890, over 100,000 boilers providing steam heat were in use. Over 2,000 had exploded during the 1880s alone. The American Society of Mechanical Engineers had been in existence for some 25 years by the time the boiler exploded at Grover. They had released some guidelines, but it was clear that inspections were rare and standards were needed. The public outcry only grew in Massachusetts after another industrial boiler explosion occurred the next year. The state passed measures establishing rules of operation. By 1914, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers had successfully pushed back against manufacturers and railroad managers who opposed boiler regulations. They published the first edition of the National Boiler and Pressure Vessel Code. A national board of inspectors soon followed. Since then, regulations ensuring safe operation and maintenance have saved countless lives.
Exciting news, people. Utopia is on the rise. Space Commander Elon Musk has announced that His Magnificence, i.e. him, intends to construct his very own private town on 3,500 acres of farmland near his new Tesla plant southeast of Austin, Texas. More than a town, Musk explains that he will create utopia in Texas, promising an ecological paradise where his Tesla workers can live and do fun things like swimming, pickleball, and paying rent to him. The gabillionaire is certainly rich enough to erect his own Muskopolis, but alas, the Utopia name is already taken. Indeed, I've been to Utopia, Texas, a small town west of San Antonio that was founded in 1855 by, cover your ears, Elon, Swiss socialists. Of course, history shows that a company town is ruled by the company, not by residents, much less socialists. And Musk has made clear at Tesla, Twitter, etc., that his personal whims rule over workers, consumers, our environment, and even truth. Which brings us to that ecological workers' paradise he's promising. Even as one arm of his empire was extolling his vision of a Garden of Eden situated along the beauty of the Colorado River, another arm was scheming to pollute it. Musk is asking Texas corporate control regulators to let him use the site to dump 140,000 gallons a day of his industrial wastewater into the Colorado. Excuse me, but that turns Elon's ecological paradise into a fraud. Worse, it adds up to Musk pouring 50 million gallons a year of his waste into the river, fouling the main water source for dozens of towns and hundreds of farms downstream. This is Jim Hightower saying, Musk wants to extend the long sordid history in our country of company town hucksters, and his latest Texas scam is proof that we should never trust a billionaire promising us paradise.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, I find this whole Trump thing to be quite amusing on a number of levels, but it is political theater. It is compelling TV, especially when you had Roger Stone and Mike Flynn, evidently with the Pastors for Trump, holding a prayer vigil And I find it hysterical that, you know, even that Stone's out there saying, you know, we prayed together on the phone. You know, Trump's a man who is completely without fear because he puts his faith in the Lord. And I'm going, really? Does anyone buy that even a little bit? I know they're playing for a specific crowd. I know that messaging is supposed to be for, you know, the people that might support Mike Pence. But does anybody actually believe that? But again, he wasn't a top-rated TV star for no reason. He knows how to get attention for himself. And here to share some thoughts on where we are and who's making money. Because again, I go back to Rupert Murdoch. It's not about red or blue. It's about green. And well, for all the clickbaiters out there, Trump is nothing but green. That's why I asked my good friend Craig Herring to come share some thoughts. Craig is the research director over at Media Matters, mediamatters.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
So I'm looking at this, and my first thought is, wow, it really is all about the money. Rupert Murdoch was right. Les Moonves was right. It's about the cash. He brings in cash because he's got compelling content.
Yeah, you know, and for those of you who are trying to get caught up here, you know, just in the past couple of days, over the past few months since the start of 2023, we've seen Trump get reinstated on the big social media platforms. First was Facebook, and then Twitter, and then last Friday in the afternoon, he was reinstated on YouTube. Now, YouTube is very important for Donald Trump. Personally and politically, YouTube has allowed him to put out his campaign messages, which is very important to his actual communication strategy, his paid strategy, and his viral strategy. But YouTube also is important to him personally because it allows him to bring in finance fundraising for his campaigns, so that Donald Trump isn't as rich as he claimed to be. He did not self-finance his campaigns. He cannot self-finance his re-election bid in 2024. But he needs to be able to reach eyeballs, and he needs to be able to put paid advertisements out on platforms like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and he needs to be able to have viral and organic reach through those social media platforms to their collectively billions of daily users. It is absolutely vital to his financial and political prospects to get back on YouTube. And it's not an accident that the day, March 17th, that his YouTube account was reinstated and fully authorized again, he posted for the first time on Facebook since his reinstatement, Donald Trump's first post on Facebook since he was temporarily suspended from the platform in the wake of the January 6th insurrection was just two words and a cleverly edited video that was a sort of homage to how long he'd been away and how complicated it was for him to come back. And it just was two words, "I'm back." Now, if you're a basketball junkie like me, you'll know that that was cribbed directly from Michael Jordan, who on March 18th, 1995, announced that he was coming back to the NBA. And returned for part of the season for the Bulls, and they went on to three-peat again. I'm a huge Michael Jordan junkie and a big basketball head, so I saw that immediately. He picked the date intentionally, but he put his "I'm back" statement out on a Friday instead of a Saturday so that it wouldn't be completely buried and he'd get some news. And it was smart. It came out at like 4:17 p.m., and it dominated the news for the rest of the day. It was all over the internet, and that's how he gets us. The man, like you said, he was not a TV star on accident. He really, really understands the media. He understands earned media, most importantly. It's just that he, as a person, is a shocking president and a terrifying political leader. But as a media property, like you said, he's incredibly valuable, and he's good at that. He's good at making money, and he's good at making money for those platforms, and that's why they're letting him back on.
No, he's a master clickbaiter. There's no question about that. But the question then becomes, the rest of us who are paying attention to this, because a lot of people, as I just talked about a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. we've gone through the Reagan era, we went through the H.W. Bush era, we went through the W era, and you know all the things that they did. We just once they left office, kind of said, never mind, they're gone. Let sleeping dogs lie. This there's got to be a point where you go, enough already. I mean, we just saw over the weekend a guy, 43 years ago, is now coming out saying, yeah, that whole October surprise thing that you knew about, that yeah, we did that. You look at what happened 20 years ago with going into Iraq. It's not even a joke, not even a secret anymore. It's a joke that, yeah, we lied about the cartoon drawings and the weapons of mass destruction. Nobody's ever held accountable. And I think that's where this moment's different. Now, the hush money thing, I think, is ridiculous. But the phone call and some of the other stuff, somebody has to be held accountable for.
Yeah. And, you know, the hush money, it's ridiculous and not ridiculous, right? Like, it's a crime. Someone went to prison for it. Michael Cohen went to jail for committing a crime on Donald Trump's behalf. He was suborned to commit a crime. And so that makes Donald Trump a conspiracy in that crime, a conspirator in that crime. Donald Trump has always been a conspirator in that crime, always, since the very outset. And the reporting that we saw first released by Trump himself, I believe on Saturday, letting his followers know on his social media platform, Truth Social, that he thought he was going to be arrested and indicted this Tuesday, March 21st. That sort of took the world by storm over the weekend and has been the dominant media narrative in the country over the past several days. And one of the arguments we're getting to see from commentators, particularly mainstream media commentators, right-wing media commentators, their argument is sort of boils down to what Jesse Waters said on television last night about Donald Trump, which is that it didn't happen, but if it did happen, it was good. And you know, that's always how it's been, right? Like if you're a Trump supporter, you think, well, this shocking accusation, and they always turn out to be true, this is false. But if it's not false, it's actually smart of him to do it. And actually, I prefer that he did it, and I wish everyone would do it that way. But only Trump can afford to do that. And that's where the right wing is coalescing with the Stormy Daniels hush money payments and the potential tax evasion and campaign finance violations associated with that hush money, which is what Michael Cohen went to jail for. Trump was a co-conspirator in that. There are criminal penalties for crimes. Just because this isn't the worst thing he ever did doesn't mean that he shouldn't face consequences from it. But one of the things we're beginning to see from mainstream commentators is the argument that actually that Trump oughtn't or shouldn't face this first or face this at all because it's not the worst thing he ever did. Some people have pointed out that, say, like Al Capone wasn't sent to jail for all of the people he killed or all of the assassinations that he plotted and funded or all of the judges that he paid off. He went to jail for tax evasion. And this is sort of the Capone moment for Trump, if it's anything. But what remains to be seen is whether or not he'll be arrested, whether or not he'll be indicted, whether or not he'll be arraigned, whether there will be a public spectacle, and what the response from the right wing will be. We know what the right wing wants their response to be, which is loud and proud. But if today's turnouts at these pro-Trump sort of flash mobs that were organized around the country in New York and in Mar-a-Lago, if today's turnout is anything indicative of what we can expect tomorrow or in the future, we saw reporting from Ben Collins at NBC News that reporters outnumbered protesters at these supposed pro-Trump MAGA rally Patriot blockade events. They're talking about putting a MAGA moat around Mar-a-Lago so that the police can't come and get him. And people are asking Ron DeSantis if he will obstruct the extradition of Donald Trump to New York City. And of course, New York City is widely seen as a Democratic stronghold, but there are millions of Republicans in the New York City metro area as well. And they're calling on each other to go out to the courthouse and surround it and prevent the sort of orderly processing of Trump's arraignment, indictment, arrest, et cetera, which is very similar to what we saw, of course, on January 6, 2021, with the besieging and sacking of the United States Capitol building. But it remains to be seen if people will actually show up to this. One of the things that Media Matters has been circulating is guidance to allies and other research organizations and media organizations explaining some of the right-wing media phenomena that we're seeing. And because over the past 2 years, the right-wing media has tried so hard to distance itself from the legal consequences of January 6, 2021, we actually see that they've kind of undermined their own organizing ability with their capacity to put together these big rallies, because essentially everyone in the social network of these right wingers who might turn out is worried that someone else is working with the feds, right? Everyone who sacked the Capitol building, you know, when it was 1 p.m. on January 6, 2021, Laura Ingraham was on Fox News cheering. You know, Tucker Carlson was tweeting his thumbs off. Lauren Boebert was saying this is 1776 again. But by that night, when people had started to be arrested and processed, and when the depictions of the violence and the really shocking spectacle of that day were just etched into our national memory and were broadcast internationally live for hours and hours that day, all of a sudden it was Antifa actually did this. People dressed as Trump supporters did this. The people who were motivating and instigating and organizing this were actually undercover federal officers, not earnest Trump supporters. And because they've laid that groundwork, and repeated those lies over and over and over for 2 years, they're actually having a lot of trouble organizing and motivating people to come out to these events. That doesn't mean they shouldn't be that they should be taken lightly. But it is a real catch-22 that the right wing has found themselves in. They've undermined their own base very significantly with their responses to January 6th. And that might be the thing that is undermining their ability to put people in the streets and create the MAGA moat and the Patriot blockade that they're talking about right now with Donald Trump's potential arrest.
Is it also possible that some people are looking at this and going, you know, maybe there's some truth in some of this. Maybe we should be holding the rich and powerful accountable for things that they actually did? Because, you know, having had some conversations with Trump supporters over the weekend, a lot of them weren't motivated. I mean, you're going out and taking the country back, getting the militia suit on and going and marching in the streets. And no, they got to go to work Monday morning. They got lives to lead. You know, how much of this is that as well?
You know, I can't speak to the motivations of any of these individuals or the mob en masse, but I could point to some indicators that may be correct. How did Ron DeSantis respond to these reports that Trump might face an arrest and indictment? He made sure to include the word porn star as much as possible and hush money as much as possible and say, I don't know anything about this stuff that some other politicians might know about. I don't know how this works, but it's cockamamie and these are low consequences. This is a George Soros DA. And, you know, he's doing all of the dog whistles and all the games and gimmicks. But Ron DeSantis, if he decides to announce his run for president, he needs to steal a huge chunk of Donald Trump's core base. And it seems as if he thinks his play is to reach out to those people who are just exhausted by the Stormy Daniels-ness of Trump and tell them, you know, like, I'm the right-wing authoritarian you can trust. I'm the one who isn't going to bring you, who isn't going to, like, make you ashamed to wear my hat around in public.
Yeah, you're not going to wear the hood. You'll wear the hat.
Yeah, you can wear the white face mask, but not the red hat. Whether or not that works, whether or not his ploy is correct, remains to be seen. Maybe we'll start to find out tomorrow. But that certainly seems to be his tactic. And that might indicate some truth to your intuition that, you know, a lot of people are fed up with this. And I know you're not speaking just of intuition. You have an actual anecdote. You've talked to real people. He's talked to real people, too. And I believe that that's probably part of his motivation. Whether or not that's going to succeed with the right wing media, which don't seem to be quite exhausted by Trump, that remains to be seen.
No, because they're making money off of it. I mean, at the end of the day, this is about getting ears on the radio, eyes on the TV, you know, people reaching in their pockets to buy flags and newsletters and all of this stuff. He's an industry, and he's delivering.
And that's absolutely true. You know, if you go to the website, MediaMatters.org, we have a clip from Sunday's edition of CBS's Face the Nation. And NYU media ethics professor Scott Galloway was on Face the Nation talking about the reinstatement of Trump and what it means. And he kind of like cut to the chase. And he said, like, look, they're doing this because he's now relevant and potentially profitable for these companies. It's not an accident that when he became Mr. Irrelevant in the lame duck phase of his presidency, when his attempt to steal the election and overturn the results, when all those attempts had failed and the sieging of the Capitol had failed, it was only after the Capitol was cleared that all these companies suddenly, you know, had their Damascus Road conversions and kicked Trump off their platforms because he was now irrelevant. They could move on. They didn't need him. But now that he's back, now that he's announced his candidacy, and now that he is the Republican frontrunner, whether or not he wins remains to be seen, but he's absolutely the frontrunner. Now that he's the frontrunner, they need that hundreds of millions of dollars of advertising revenue and organic growth and the user base that Trump promises and that Trump can bring. And that's why they're bringing him back. This is pure capitalism. This isn't a cartel. This isn't a collusion. This isn't the corporatocracy trying to instill their liberal agenda. This is just dollar signs. And I think that the clip we have on the website cuts to the chase very, very easily in less than 90 seconds. And frankly, he does a better job of synopsis than I did just now.
No, absolutely. It's all about the money. And that's part of the problem with our media culture is they're feeding us not what we need, but what people want. And they want the horse race. They want the division. They want the chaos. And look, you know, Trump thrives in chaotic. I think it was Chris Christie who said, you know, Trump thrives in turmoil and chaos, which is why he keeps trying to create turmoil and chaos. It's what's worked for him.
And the media benefit from that too. That, I think that's part of the reason also that we saw so many media over the 4 years of his administration talk about a potential change in tone and a pivot from Trump. We actually saw this. It was very peculiar and frankly kind of a ridiculous episode. This morning, a CNN legal analyst was talking about Trump's inciting posts that he made on Truth Social over the weekend. So on Saturday, it starts with him calling for protests. And if you're a Trump supporter, the protest, that means J6, right? That means yep. Siege the Capitol. We know what that means. We saw it happen.
Yep.
So on Saturday and Sunday, he's calling for protests. But on Monday, he wasn't calling for protests. He was talking about George Soros. He was spreading conspiracies. He was asking for the police to not show up to work and to not help their corrupt Democratic politicians arrest and indict and arraign him. But he wasn't specifically calling for violence in, quote, all of his posts. And CNN latched onto that. And the reporter, who otherwise was reporting all of the dangerous stuff that Trump was doing, all of the incitement that he was posting, and she said, maybe that's an indication that some people in his orbit are getting through because all of what he posted wasn't violent. And it was like, even in that instance, this person is kind of grasping for the pivot, the presidential pivot.
It's never coming. No, look, when he was in office, I'd have people come on and say, oh, he's going to resign any day now. And that was like for the whole thing. And I'm going, he's never mm-hmm. resigning. I remember all the people, Mueller's coming, Mueller's never coming. And I kind of feel the same way in this moment. Look, there might be indictments that are brought down. But ultimately, I don't see him going to jail. I just don't. No. Well, I don't feel like being Charlie Brown again and again and again.
Yeah. And that's we all feel like that. I've been talking with some of my colleagues about that for a long time. There was a time I thought the Access Hollywood tape, like a lot of media observers, journalists, people watching that October 6th, 2016, we thought that was the end.
Yeah.
Right. David Farenthold had just uncovered the thing that was going to destroy Trump. And the thing is that for a few days it was, but then what happened is WikiLeaks came out with their hacked email dump. They reclaimed the narrative. James Comey produces his Halloween dated letter, reinserting Hillary Clinton and the word FBI investigation into the narrative. And the rest is history. But I think this is actually an important potential point. You know, a lot of people have become very nihilistic about Trump. They think nothing matters, nothing affects him. But these things actually do affect him quite a lot. And if you ever were to track his actual polling numbers over the course of his 4 years in office or his public polling now, he is really affected by these big scandals. They do, you know, he stays within a tight bar. He never drops, you know, the bottom never falls out like post-Iraq War George W. Bush. But these big things do affect him. And remember, he lost. Not only did he only get, you know, 45% of the vote when he won, he got an even smaller vote share as an incumbent president, and he lost. And he lost a bunch of red states that hadn't changed in 30 years. So this stuff does affect him.
Yeah.
And if it's going to affect him in the public, we might not see that for a year and a half until Election Day 2024. But being indicted matters. The looming indictment for Hillary Clinton, which never came, absolutely mattered. It absolutely affected the elections. Real indictments at the city level in New York's district attorney, at the county level with the Fulton County prosecution over his attempt to defraud the election in Georgia, or potential federal indictments for his role in January 6th or other federal crimes that the Justice Department is currently looking into, those will matter. Will they make the bottom fall out? Will they cost him the primary? Who knows? But will they cost him a general election? That's entirely plausible because we've seen these scandals pile up before.
Yeah.
This is the reason he lost.
My hope is he gets the nomination and he gets crushed in the general. But again, I know I'm not supposed to wish that out loud because it could go the other way. And that's where we will see. But Greg, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. Great stuff as always. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Our good friend Craig Harrington. Make sure to check out their website, MediaMatters.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around and listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
This day in labor history, the year was 1854. That was the day that the founders of what became the Republican Party met in Ripon, Wisconsin. The idea was to form a new party opposed to the Southern labor system based on slavery. That July, the Republicans held their first convention in Michigan. Their motto became free soil, free labor, free men. But as historian Eric Foner has explained, proclaiming the superiority of free labor was easy. Implementing that vision proved more troublesome. Women and free black residents living in the North often found it difficult, if not impossible, to find safe, good-paying jobs in the so-called free labor system. 2 years after the new party was founded, Republicans ran their first presidential candidate, John C. Fremont. Fremont was a military man, explorer, and map maker of the American West. He carried 11 northern states, but failed to win the presidency. The next election, Republicans nominated Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln won 18 northern states, and for the first time, a Republican sat in the White House. With the victory of a free labor candidate, the country stood on the brink of civil war. The question of slave labor would be settled on the battlefield. In his first address to Congress, President Lincoln declared, "Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could have never existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration." Given the thoughts of the first Republican president, could you imagine a leader in the Republican Party making such a statement today?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So JJ just sent me an email. Why in God's name would you want Trump to win the GOP primary? Look, I think he has to be beaten at the polls and soundly. I think it has to happen again, and it has to happen in a big way. Or we're going to continue to have these, everything was stolen from us, this victim complex that the right has. And look, I ran into it over the weekend where I ran into some people who were like, you know, Trump was cheated. You know Trump was cheated. I'm going, no, like 60 hearings. We exhausted every court option possible. There. I know you believe, but the reality is what the reality is. And this is where I think, you know, look, if it's not Trump who gets beat in 2024, I don't know that you can move forward. Because here's the thing, and this is the important point in all this. We are a polar divided country right now. And the thing is, there are things that we agree on. The problem is we're being told different things. A perfect example. A listener sent me this Jordan Peterson video. I'm not a big Jordan Peterson fan. I'm not in either camp. I'm not in the definitely don't love him, but I don't hate him either. It's the same thing with Andrew Tate. I'm not in the, oh my God, he's a great, and I don't hate him either. He's got some interesting things to say. I don't agree with many of them, but there's a kernel of reality in some of it. One of the things that Jordan Peterson said is he's talking about, you know, the prices of everything going up. You know, your fuel's going up and food's going up and, you know, they're doing this on purpose. You know, and he asked the question, how much short-term pain are you going to be required? You know, all of this pain you're going to, and all this suffering because of this. And he used a phrase, Deloitte-style moralists, which I guess this now is the catch-all for, you know, the LGBTQ plus folks, for environmentalists, anyone who's saying, you know, we should make changes to accommodate, you know, the less fortunate, to accommodate the poor, the needy, whatever the group is. He's lumping them together. And, you know, never mind the fact that, yeah, food prices go up, shelter's going up, energy costs are going up. It's capitalism. Welcome to capitalism. Now he's trying to say, no, no, it's this Deloitte style moralism. It's because of these PR firms that do all this stuff. You go, no, no, it's capitalism that does this stuff. It's the, and then again, this is where the right and the left can agree. Energy prices are too high. Wages are too low. Things are not right. But the Jordan Petersons and the folks on the extreme right, they're pushing their narrative. And their narrative is that things are bad because we give equal rights to others. Not the fact that we've...
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.